The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivy for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the November-December issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. We're going to begin in Who's Who in our third line this week. Madison Booker, Texas Longhorn forward. Height, 6'1", born April 29th, 2005. Hometown, Richland, Missouri. Booker won the Cheryl Miller Award as the best small forward in the nation. Last year, as a freshman, she also chipped in at point guard, finishing the season with 5.0 assists per game to go along with her 16.5 points. Booker, who was a second-team All-American, led the Longhorns to a 33-5 record and a berth in the Elite Eight. But did you know Booker was the first freshman to be nominated Big 12 Player of the Year? Next we have Aretmi Panarin, New York Rangers left wing. His height is 6 feet. His weight is 173 pounds. He was born October 30th, 1991, hometown, Karkino, Russia. After not being picked in the 2010 NHL draft, Panarin played in Russia until he signed with the Blackhawks in 2015 with Chicago. With Chicago, he won the Calder Trophy as the NHL's top rookie. Panarin joined the Rangers in 2019 and has scored at least 90 points in 4 of his 5 seasons in New York, including last year when he had 120. Did you know, though, Panarin's nickname is Bread or Breadman due to the fact that his last name is similar to the Panera bread chain of restaurants? And finally, we have Wade Taylor IV, Texas A&M Aggies guard. His height is 6 feet. His weight is 175 pounds. He was born June 5, 2003, hometown, Dallas, Texas. As a junior, Taylor was named All-SEC after setting a school record with 98 three-pointers. He averaged 19.1 points per game, including 27.3 in the SEC tournament. Taylor, who had 687 points last season, needs just 403 to become the leading scorer in Aggies history. Did you know, though? Texas A&M fans used the expression "gig'em" to support the Aggies. It originated before a 1930 football game against the TCU Horned Frogs. A gig is a frog-hunting tool. Rookies, give them a rest. From Kip Shoremore. Sometimes you can't help but wish a player had started their career earlier. Randy Johnson didn't get in a full major league season until he was ancient, 25 years old. But he ended up with 4,875 career strikeouts. If only he had started at a more reasonable age, he could have been just the second pitcher to fan 5,000 batters. Dennis Rodman began his NBA career at 25 and didn't average double-digit rebounds until he was 29. Kurt Warner became a starting quarterback at age 28. Speaking of Hall of Fame QBs, what if Aaron Rodgers hadn't been blocked by Brett Favre until he was 25? Or if Steve Young hadn't stuck behind Joe Montana until his 30s? By age 9, I had already overtaken Buzz Beamer as this magazine's most prominent personality. these kinds of tantalizing hypotheticals don't come up as much anymore. Any highly touted young quarterback will sit for at most a half season, not a decade like poor Steve Young. This year, 3 rookie QBs were named Week 1 starters: Jaden Daniels, Bo Nix, and Caleb Williams. For those of us who love a long career with the biggest pile of accumulated stats possible, it's an exciting time to be a fan. At least it was, until Week 1 actually happened. Nix tossed 2 interceptions and no touchdowns. Williams threw for 93 yards. Daniels managed the best debut of the three, 184 yards with two rushing touchdowns. Womp, womp. Maybe there's value in sitting for a while. College offenses and off-season training programs have come a long way. In theory, that means quarterbacks come to the NFL more game-ready than ever. But that's not all that's going on. Consider this familiar tale. An owner hires a new coach to revive a struggling franchise. The coach hitches his wagon to a first-round signal caller. The young passer gets touted as the team's savior. And the coach, hired on promises of a quick turnaround, feels pressure to deploy this potential superstar, find out what he has, and change his team's fortunes. Few coaches in today's NFL have the job security to ignore antsy fans and hand a young QB the clipboard for a year or two. And with quarterbacks going higher and higher in the draft, six in the first 12 picks this year, fewer prospects even end up on teams with a decent vet who can mentor them. No wonder, given these incentives, that nobody learned from the bench anymore. And when young players are getting to play, they're not necessarily improving. Learning on the job can be tough. Mistakes can be a great teacher, but too many mistakes too soon on a big stage can be demoralizing. Take an example from another sport. Cliff Lee. A fairly highly touted prospect, Lee was one of four players sent from Montreal to Cleveland in the infamous Bartolo Colon trade in 2002. Cleveland called up the young pitcher that year. He had an up-and-down 5 years before the team sent the struggling Lee, then 28, back down to the minors. When he returned to the bigs in 2008, he went 22-3 with a 2.54 ERA and won the American League Cy Young Award. He played six more seasons as one of baseball's top hurlers. Viewed through the lens of Lee's career, Johnson seems more like a blueprint than a what-if. Had Cleveland sent an inconsistent young Lee to a AAA sooner, would he have blossomed sooner? Maybe a chance to break into the majors with a little more seasoning like Johnson would have elevated a very good career to a slam-dunk Hall of Fame case. Every league has examples of dudes who put up big numbers as rookies and then never repeated them. Robert Griffin III, Jahlil Okafor, Neil Yakupov, etc. Lots of playing time and raw talent can combine for a pretty nice first year. Being the go-to guy on a bad team, though, means a rookie has no one to learn from. They miss out on not just strategic tips, but also examples of how to prepare and practice to ensure they're in it for the long run. I hope Jaden Daniels, Bo Nix, and Caleb Williams have great careers, but it's a lot of pressure to perform right away. Not everyone has the raw kip ability to come out firing and never let up. Future stars, Elliot and Miles Gordon. Birthplace, Columbus, Ohio. Sport, bowling. When Elliot, 15, and Miles, 13, were younger, they would sometimes get on each other's case if one rolled a bad shot. That doesn't happen as often now, not only because the brothers say they're more than mature, but also because they are a dynamic duo. At the 2024 Junior Gold National Championships, Elliot and Miles were the first brothers to finish the qualifying round as the top two bowlers in the same division. Elliot went on to win the under-15 title. If we keep each other locked in, says Miles, we know we're probably going to win. November birthdays. November 1st, Oakland A's slugger Brent Rooker hits the big 3-0. November 4th. All-star guard Tyrese Maxey of the Philadelphia 76ers is 24 years old. And November 6th, Florida Panthers center Sam Reinhart celebrates his 29th birthday. How it started. Soccer-style kickers completed their takeover of the NFL years ago. Now, there's a new trend, actual soccer players hitting the gridiron. Plenty of NFL players had big seasons in 1982. Chargers quarterback Dan Fouts threw for 2,883 yards in the strike-shortened nine-game season. That translates to 5,446 in a 17-game season. His top target, Wes Chandler, had 1,032 receiving yards in eight games, the equivalent of 2,193 in a full season. But the MVP award went to Washington's Mark Moseley, a kicker. Now, we're not disparaging Moseley. He made 20 of 21 field goal attempts. But if the voters who were wowed by that performance could see that state of kicking now, their minds would be totally blown. Moseley began his career in the early 1970s, when most kickers booted the ball straight on. When he retired after the 86 season, he was the last of that breed. Every kicker since has used a soccer-style approach. Now there's a new trend emerging, soccer players making the transition to football relatively late in life. And if Brandon Aubrey of the Cowboys keeps kicking like he has since the start of last season, we're going to be seeing a lot more crossover cases. A lifelong soccer player, Aubrey was drafted in the first round of the MLS Super Draft out of Notre Dame by Toronto FC in 2017. After two seasons toiling in lower divisions, he retired from soccer. As he was considering what to do with his life after soccer, Aubrey was watching an NFL game with his wife. She saw a kicker, suggested Aubrey do his job just as well. So Aubrey signed up for a free class in Dallas with Brian Egan, the founder of the Performance Kicking Academy. Egan's classes were normally taken by kids in middle school and high school. After Aubrey kicked, he had what Egan called a grown man conversation about whether or not Aubrey had a future. They decided he did and started working together to transition from football to football. There's 100 different ways to strike a soccer ball, says Egan. They put spin on the ball, there's passing, shooting, long kicks, and then when you translate that into football, it's just one specific ball strike that you're looking for each time. It's an important one. In 1982, when Moseley was the MVP, teams made an average of 1.2 field goals per game and converted 68.2% of their kicks. Last year, those numbers were 1.7 and 85.9%, and distance has never been more significant. In Moseley's MVP campaign, the longest kick he made was 48 yards, and he didn't even attempt a 50-yarder. Last year, when Aubrey was 36 of 38 kicks in his first season with the Cowboys, he made all 10 of his attempts from 50 or longer, and in week one of this year, he had a 66-yarder nullified by a penalty. As participation in youth football dwindles, teams are certain to explore new avenues for players. Thanks to Aubrey, that will include soccer teams. Storm warning. 2024 basketball preview. Oklahoma City has a combination of young talent and future draft picks that will have the rest of the NBA feeling thunderstruck. There was a moment in June, shortly after the draft, when Thunder general manager Sam Presti sat down to address the media. Before he discussed his team's picks, he thanked his scouts, the people whose legwork and time spent traveling helped Presti decide which to select. The evaluators and the scouts spend so much time away, travel all over the world, he said. There's a lot of rental car returns at 5 in the morning, connecting flights to far-off lands. There's a million stories like that. Well, they had better get used to it because they're going to be remarkably busy for the next several years. Oklahoma City has amassed a staggering bounty of draft picks, as many as 27, including 12 first-rounders in the next 5 years. That kind of draft capital is the envy of every GM who is trying to rebuild an NBA team. But here's the catch. The Thunder aren't rebuilding. In fact, they might just be the best team in the league. Presti has constructed a roster that is remarkably balanced. The offense, built around MVP runner-up Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, was third in the NBA in efficiency last year. The defense, anchored by 7'1" rim protector Chet Holmgren and forward Jalen Williams, ranked fourth, and the Thunder did all of that with only one rotation player over the age of 25. Presti made the team even tougher and more experienced in the offseason, acquiring all-defensive guard Alex Caruso. "I looked up highlights on YouTube of them playing defense," Caruso said when he was traded. "I was really excited. I'm excited to add to that." From the ground up, Oklahoma City is by NBA standards a small city. Unlike New York or Los Angeles, it's not a glitzy destination for free agents, so the Thunder have historically built through the draft, and Presti is very good at that. From 2007 to 2009, he selected three future Hall of Famers, Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden. More recently, he snagged Holmgren second overall in the 2020 draft, then got Williams later in that draft. The current group is eerily similar to Durant's Thunder. They're young and tight-knit. Holmgren and Alexander are especially close, which was evident in their TV commercial in which they sang a parody of a Christina Aguilera song. Durant and his crew would go eat wings together and then play video games until bedtime. "Every day I wake up, I feel blessed to be here," Durant said in 2010. But Presti ultimately couldn't keep the team together. They made the finals in 2012, but lost to the Heat in five games. Now, though, Presti not only has a young core, but also the tool to find complementary players. On draft night back in June, he packaged five second-round picks and sent them to the Knicks for the rights to Dylan Jones, a player who might have been available much later. And it's not like the Thunder need much. Holmgren, who missed the entire 22-23 season with a foot injury, is a basketball unicorn, a quadruple-double waiting to happen. He can shoot from anywhere. He made 37% of his threes last year, has the passing touch of a guard, and is long enough to grab any rebound or block any shot. Add in the two-way talents of Alexander and Williams, and you've got a team that won 57 games last year, 2 years after winning just 24. Their inexperience showed in the playoffs when Dallas knocked OKC out in the second round. So the scouts will continue to return rental cars at the crack of dawn as they travel the world looking for a player or two to push the team over the hump. And unlike with most contending teams, there's not a sense of urgency, the feeling that a title window is closing. The Thunder is rolling in Oklahoma City and is going to be loud for a long time. NCAA. UConn, the one and only double dipping school. In 1985, Gina Oriana was hired as the women's basketball coach at Connecticut, which is located in the small town of Storrs. Neither the women's nor the men's programs were especially strong. "We're not in a recruiting area where a lot of players are growing up," Oriana says. "We're not in a major city. We didn't have a great arena on campus. I can't think of any positive that would have been there 40 years ago to come to school here when I got the job. So what we found out during those first three or four recruiting classes was we had to get kids that didn't care about any of that. How we recruit hasn't changed one iota. This is a place where you come to work. That philosophy of working is working. UConn has won 11 women's titles, and the ethos has rubbed off on the men's program as well. There was a very much parallel progression," says Oriema. "Under three coaches, the Huskies have won six championships, and twice in 2004 and 2014, UConn claimed both titles. A third double dip isn't out of the question. Oriema's team went 33-6 last season and will feature the best returning player in the country, Paige Beckers, as well as the top recruit, Sarah Strong. The men, coached by Dan Hurley, have won the last two national championships. Even though they lost lottery picks Stephon Castle and Donovan Klingon, the Huskies are always going to tough beat under Hurley, who has impressed his UConn counterpart. He's done an unbelievable job of taking high-level talent and mixing it with some other guys, says Auriemma. But he coaches them like they're in junior high. He teaches them like this is how you dribble a basketball. Basic, yes, but it's working. Iowa State. If only the NCAA had a co-ed competition, Iowa State can do it all. Play tenacious defense and score in bunches. The problem? The men do the former. The women do the latter. Led by center Audie Crooks, the Cyclone women went 21-12 despite having the worst defense in the Big 12. The men, meanwhile, had one of the top defenses in the country, epitomized by pesky point guard Keyshawn Gilbert. The trick now is to combine the two teams' strengths. The appeal of playing with Crooks lured a pair of sharpshooting transfers to Iowa State. While that doesn't help the defense, it means the Cyclones can't rely on outgunning opponents. The arrival of 6'11" DeSean Jackson from Charlotte will make the men even more formidable on D, and possibly add another facet to the offense. They need only look all at the women's program to see what a center can do for an attack. Trending. Alona Mayer, USA Rugby. A breakout star at the Paris Olympics, the rugby player helped the United States to a bronze medal while sending positive message about body images. One of the best players in one of the roughest sports in the world competes while wearing lipstick. Alona Mayer does it for a reason. She wants to show that her sport, rugby, isn't just for men and that she can embrace the side of her that likes wearing makeup while also playing a game that places a premium on strength and toughness. Mayer is arguably the most popular rugby player, man or woman, in the world. She burst onto the scene at the Tokyo Olympics in 2021, attracting attention for her heartfelt yet silly social media posts. 3 years later in Paris, she led the United States team to a bronze medal in rugby sevens, a fast-paced 7-on-7 version of the game. She now has more social media followers than anyone else in her sport. So it's ironic that when Mayer was growing up, she didn't like being photographed. Mayer was bigger than most of her friends. It took some time for her to become comfortable in her own skin. To be this confident, she had to go through hard things, says her older sister Olivia. She went years feeling shy and not beautiful. Now, though, she's unapologetic about who she is, and she credits her sport for that. I love that rugby showed me what I can do, Mayer says. It showed me how capable my body is. The formerly shy kid who hated cameras doesn't just post social media content nearly every day. This fall, she will be appearing on Dancing with the Stars, where she hopes to show off the athleticism and grace that helped get her where she is. Quick learner. When she was in high school, Mayer was given one rule by her parents: always be doing something. That was rarely a problem. Mayer was an all-state athlete in basketball and field hockey at Burlington, Vermont High, so she had plenty of activities to keep her occupied. Until the end of her senior year, Mayer had always played softball at that time of the year, but it wasn't her favorite sport, so she went on the lookout for a replacement. Her father, Michael, had been a rugby player and coach and suggested she join a club. She was an immediate hit. Rugby seemed to combine all of the things required by the other sports Mayer played: speed, strength, grit. After the first practice, Mayer's coach called her dad and told him to expect her to hear from college recruiters. Sure enough, the calls started coming in. Mayer spent 1 year at Norwich University in Vermont. In a game against Quinnipiac, she made quite an impression on the opposing coach, Becky Carlson. I specifically remember saying, I would give my right arm to have that girl, Carlson recalled a few years later. Mayer transferred to Quinnipiac and, while earning a degree in nursing, led the school to 3 national championships. That caught the attention of the United States national team. She traveled to Tokyo, where the United States finished a disappointing 6th. But Tokyo was where Mayer began to attract the attention of people outside the rugby community. Her clever posts got her plenty of followers and, of course, drew out the trolls. Before the Paris Games, one commenter calculated and mocked Mayer's body mass index, a figure that takes into account a person's height and weight. According to the calculation, Mayer was technically overweight. Her response was simple: "I'm going to the Olympics. You're not." In France, Mayer and her teammates fell in the semifinals but beat Australia in the bronze medal match. It was a fitting end to the Olympics for Mayer, a fierce competitor who backed down from no one, a confident woman who played in lipstick, the proud owner of a degree in nursing. All traits that contribute to Mayer's personal motto: Beast, Beauty, Brains. What's the call? Number one, fetch. Buzz and Whitney are closing out a round of golf at the Treehouse Country Club. Buzz whacks his approach shot towards the green, then whistles and yells, "Go get it, boy." Buckethead chases down the ball, and as it is still rolling in the fairway, picks it up in his mouth and deposits it in the hole. Whitney is outraged. Buzz is elated. What's the call? Do 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 do. The ball is placed at the point where Buckethead picked it up. However, if Buzz could not have trained Buckethead to deflect the ball into the hole, he'd have had a case for the shot counting. Next, pick a winner. In a game under NBA rules, Logan Strong of the Celine Dreams goes to set a back screen for his teammate, Evan Proud. He bumps up right against defender Sam Loud, springing Evan free to cut to the basket. Sam says it's an illegal screen, but the Dreams coach argues that since Evan was not moving when he set the screen, it's legal. Who's right? Do 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 do. It's an illegal screen. If the defender can't see the screener, the screen must give him one step. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sports Illustrated for Kids is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.